And a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next hour, as Spain prepares to go to the polls, we talk to El País about how the right-wing Popular Party is expected to sweep the boards this weekend. And we hear how the Asian property market is faring in turbulent times.
I don't think anywhere in the world is escaping what's going on in Europe at the moment, and also, you know, concerns about the recovery of the American economy. So it's having an impact on Asia.
Also on the programme, we have some Israeli sabre-rattling and some defecting footballers. All that right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The Arab League, stung into action by months of bloodshed in Syria, met opponents of President Bashar al-Assad today, a day after violence in his country claimed 69 more lives. After months of hesitation, the League decided on Saturday to discipline Syria for pursuing a violent crackdown on dissent instead of implementing an Arab peace initiative. It stopped short of calling for Assad's departure or proposing any Libya-style foreign military intervention in Syria. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has added his voice to the call for an end to the violence in the country.
It is crucially important now that President Assad must immediately stop killing his own people and agree implement this agreement with the League of Arab States.
Three Norwegians accused of plotting with al-Qaeda's help to bomb a Danish newspaper for printing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad have pleaded not guilty to the charges in court today. The alleged ringleader, Mikhail Davoud, learned how to use explosives at an al-Qaeda camp in Pakistan and made an agreement with the terror organisation to blow up Denmark's daily newspaper Jyllandsposten. Prosecutor Geir Evanger said the alleged al-Qaeda link increased the severity of the case.
I think it's a very serious case because of the al-Qaeda dimension. And we have just had one other case like this before. So, but the international dimension makes the case very serious in Norway.
France came under heavy fire on global markets today, reflecting fears that the Eurozone's second biggest economy is being sucked into a spiralling debt crisis, after warning that Paris's failure to adapt should be ringing alarm bells. Nervous markets also show concern about whether Italy's Mario Monti and the new Greek leader Lukas Papademos, unelected European technocrats without a domestic political base, can impose tough austerity measures and economic reform. Poland's inflation soared above expectations in October due to rebounding food prices and a floundering zloty, raising the prospect of further interventions by the central bank to prop up the local currency instead of raising interest rates further. Austerity measures brought in to tackle Europe's economic crisis may cause a rise in drug-related HIV infections as stretched health services struggle to cope, according to the EU's narcotics agency. Greece, which is facing huge cutbacks, reported a large outbreak of HIV infections among drug users in July, the Lisbon-based agency said in its yearly report. New infections were also reported in Bulgaria, Estonia and Lithuania. Use of cocaine may have peaked in Europe as cash-trapped users struggle to pay for their habit. New York police evicted Occupy Wall Street protesters from a park in the city's financial district earlier today, 2 months after they set up camp and sparked a national movement against economic inequality. Wearing helmets and carrying shields and batons, hundreds of police dismantled the sea of tents and protest signs at Zuccotti Park, arresting 147 people, including about a dozen, who chained themselves to each other and to the trees. Earlier this morning, protester Angelique Richard said it was peaceful.
What's happening now is what we call a soft lock and a hard lock, where people stand around the front and lock arms, and behind them are rows of people who are sitting down with their legs locked around each other and their arms locked around each other.
And London city authorities said today they were resuming legal action to try to shift anti-capitalism protesters who've set up camp at St Paul's Cathedral. Around 200 tents have been pitched close to St Paul's after protesters were last month denied access to the nearby London Stock Exchange. Finally, Iraq's cabinet approved a $17 billion deal with Royal Dutch Shell and Mitsubishi today to capture gas that is now being flared off into the atmosphere at southern oil fields. The 25-year venture is expected to help Iraq make use of more than 700 million cubic feet per day of gas that's being burned off at three major fields around the southern oil hub of Basra and open the door to the export of liquefied gas. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Now let's take a look at the weather from around the world with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And the warmest weather in Europe currently is across Siberia, western France and in Italy, around 15 to 18 degrees here. The rest of Europe is feeling the autumn chill, frosty nights, Germany and Switzerland eastwards. Wednesday's city forecast, Moscow 0 degrees, cloudy with some snow, Vienna 4 degrees, quite sunny, Frankfurt 6 Celsius, some sunshine here, and in London 12 degrees with a little bit of sun. Air travel, quite a strong jet stream forming over the Atlantic for westbound flights, so a headwind and bumpy conditions if you're heading to the US. North America, and a wet couple of days on the way for the eastern half of the US from Nashville to New York City, also wind and a rain snow mix for Washington State and into British Columbia. Wednesday's city forecast, Vancouver 8 degrees, rain, snow over the mountains. In Los Angeles, 19 degrees and sunny here. New York City, 13 degrees with some rain. And in Miami, it's 29 and sunny. And as far as air travel goes, severe thunderstorms in eastern Texas and Louisiana. The weather at Houston Airport could be a little bit choppy. Now let's head over to South America. And Tuesday through Wednesday, thunderstorms affecting much of southern Brazil. Meanwhile, across Argentina, a lot of good weather. And a quick outlook, Rio de Janeiro, 24 degrees, chance of thunder here for Wednesday. Sao Paulo, 20 Celsius with rain showers. In Caracas, 28 and tropical showers. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed. Now, let's have a look at the time. It's just 7 minutes past the hour here at Midori House in London. In a moment, Spain expects a big swing to the right. Stay with us.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afternoon to Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
24. And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, Spain goes to the polls this weekend. The outgoing left-leaning president, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, has called an early presidential election in the perhaps mistaken belief that he's leaving with the foundations of economic recovery firmly laid. But the opposition now seems to set to storm the boards. Unemployment's at a 15-year high, and opinion polls place the leader of the centre-right People's Party with a 15% lead. Walter Oppenheimer is from the Spanish newspaper El País. I spoke to him on a mobile phone earlier today. I began by asking him what the main issues of the campaigns have been so far.
The only issue in this election was the economical situation in Spain. And people is really very, very angry with the socialist government. And this is why everybody is expecting a change of government and the conservative of the Popular Party, the Partido Popular, winning the election very clearly.
There was a feeling, was there not, in the television debate between Rubalcaba on the left and Rajoy on the right, that Rubalcaba was just admitting defeat. Explain to me a little bit about what happened in that televised debate a few days ago.
Well, the problem for the socialists, or for Mr. Rubalcaba, is that all the polls, all the opinion polls, give to the Popular Party a huge advantage. So everybody knows that the Popular Party is going to win. The only goal of Mr. Rubalcaba or the Socialist Party is to reduce the margins of this winning. Try and the tactics. His tactics were to try to scare the people about what was going to happen if the Popular Party goes back to government. But I think it was a huge mistake. Actually, I agree. He looks admitting defeat, which means you are going to be defeated. Absolutely.
Why do you think the left and Zapatero have become so unpopular in Spain?
Basically, because they deny the existence of the economical crisis, when everybody knew Spain was going to have a huge crisis because all the other developed countries were having this crisis. So why Spain was going to be an exception? Spain has not been an exception. I don't think people believe that the government could do many, many things once the crisis was there. But at least don't deny reality. Try to act, the sooner the better.
And to what degree has the issue of the economy played a part in the election campaigning?
I understand was the only real issue. We didn't talk about anything more in Spain, only about economy and who is guilty or not and what to do in the future. We didn't talk, for the first time in a long time, we didn't talk about the national issue, the regional question of the Basque Country or Catalonia and all that. Even when there's a big news with the terrorism, the terror campaign from ETA going finally to an end, as it looks. But when you had 22% of unemployment in the normal population and more than 50% into the young population, what do you have to go into talk about? Only about the economy.
I mean, Mr. Zapatero pushed through austerity measures in February 2009. That will have made him unpopular with every single side, won't it?
Not really. It's not because all the decisions in 2009 that Zapatero is going very down, but just because he allowed the Spanish economy to go in this situation. Everybody knows that the Popular Party is going to be much more tough than the Socialists, and everybody is accepting that. In particular, since the market started to be so nervous about Spain and among other countries. So everybody knows the coming times are going to be much worse than the times in the past. So that's not the problem. The problem is the government allowed the Spanish economy to hit too much, in particular the housing market. And not the housing market, but the construction sector. Spain was having double than the European average of the GDP coming from construction. And this is the role of the government and taxes, to put taxes to don't allow that to happen. And the government didn't do that.
You mentioned that no one is talking about the Basque separatists and ETA. I mean, it was only a couple of weeks ago that ETA declared a definitive ceasefire. Are you surprised by how little coverage it's had?
No, I'm not surprised. I think if you live in Spain, you will understand that people knew from a long time ago that ETA was but absolutely defeated. In particular, when ETA didn't comply with the last ceasefire 4 or 5 years ago, people were so disappointed that even the people who thought at that moment that the government should try to negotiate and look for a political exit to this problem, these people were so disappointed. So nobody wanted the political conversations in Spain anymore. Just they were expecting ETA to say, hi guys, this is finished, bye-bye, that's all. It's as simple as that.
And finally, writing for El País, which is a left-leaning newspaper, how does a left-leaning newspaper cover the impending defeat of a left government?
Well, you have to accept reality. First of all, El País could have sympathies for the left or the socialists. Historically, has been the case. I'm not going to deny that. But it's not dramatic for a newspaper to see a change of government, even if it's the option who you like the less. It's even good for a newspaper to be, let's say, in opposition. You can criticize maybe more freely the action of government, which is always good for the press. So it's not a big deal, really.
That was Walter Oppenheimer there from the Spanish newspaper El País, talking about this weekend's forthcoming presidential elections in Spain. Coming up, how the property world is trying to claw its way back in Asia. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House, and it's coming up to 15 minutes past the hour. Time for a bit of music now, a bit of Stephen Malkmus and Fall Away.
Skating on a thin ice pond, and I can't tell what for.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Malkmus there on Monocle 24 and Fall Away. In a little under half an hour, we'll be exploring why the Eritrean footballers just can't stop playing away. You're listening to Midori House.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Time is 18 minutes past the hour here on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson. Now let's face east, because plummeting and stagnant house prices have been one of the chief symptoms of the global financial crisis in the West, and the questionable financing behind them was one of the principal causes. But in Asia, there is hope that the housing market might just be the way out. The region's biggest property market event, MIPIM, is underway in Hong Kong, and a word that's being tentatively whispered is growth. Monocle editor Andrew Tuck spoke to the vice president of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, Chris Fossick, and Andrew asked him whether or not the reported Asian property bubble is just another load of hot air.
Chris, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, can I just ask what the mood is at the fair this year? Obviously, the world isn't as healthy as it could be. Is that being felt in Asia as well?
Yeah, I think so, Andrew. I mean, I don't think anywhere in the world is escaping what's going on in Europe at the moment. And also, you know, concerns about the recovery of the American economy. So it's having an impact on Asia. And I think it depends on which part of Asia you're in to the degree of which it has an impact. So if you're in Singapore, for instance, Singapore feels it because it's connected with Europe, it's connected with America, it exports into those markets. It's a big financial center, and obviously the financial sector is suffering because of Europe. So Singapore, I think, is feeling it. But if you then go into Southeast Asian countries like Indonesia, etc., or even China, then I think the impact is less, and you know, people are still relatively upbeat.
And just give us a sense of how the fair works, because obviously there's an exhibition side to it, but is the real business done away from the fair? Are people doing the deals in their hotel rooms and doing their deals in restaurants like where you are now? Is that really where the business goes on here?
Yeah, I think something like MIPIM is a networking event, and it's a reason for people to descend on one location. I don't think any people have any expectations over sitting down in the hall in MIPIM and really having too many detailed conversations. It's very difficult. You know, usually people are sort of transient, moving around from sort of stand to stand, etc. So you know, I think the real business is done in the meetings that are arranged off-site around the sort of fringes of MIPIM.
I was looking at a list of the kinds of people that are going there, and everyone from the Taiwanese government going there to seek partners to help them do transportation projects, to build industrial parks. I saw that the Russians were heading to Hong Kong looking for investment for the Caucasus, for luxury resorts. So it's a massive range of people, it seems, to be descending on Hong Kong trying to find cash at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about this precise moment is that there is a lot of cash being generated in Asia. You know, the economies are strong. The saving rates are high. The corporations, investors have all had a good period. So there is a lot of equity in Asia, and you know, there's a need for equity in other parts of the world. Certain parts of the world that you know they can't raise debt so easily at the moment. So for sure, overseas people are here in Asia. Europeans and I'm sure Americans as well. And you know, we'll see that continue over the next few years. I don't think it will slow down. And within Asia, then there is a strong tradition of investors investing inter-country in Asia itself. So it provides a platform for the real estate industry to do that.
So if I was heading to the fair and I had the odd, you know, $10, $20, $30 million worth investing, where would you suggest I would put it? Or where do you think the feeling is I should put that cash at the moment? Is it still a time to invest in China? Because I know that they're concerned that they have a bit of a property bubble and they're trying to deflate that slightly. Or is it still time to invest in a good old stalwart like Hong Kong?
It's a very, very difficult question to answer because people have different views about where they should. I think, you know, Asia as a region certainly would be somewhere that would be a first choice for many people. And then which parts of Asia depends on their wish to take risk. You know, you've got core markets like Singapore, Australia, which is part of Asia Pacific, of course, Japan. These markets can offer less risk than emerging markets, maybe like China or India or some of the Southeast Asian countries like Indonesia. So I think it depends on your risk appetite. But yes, for sure, there are some concerns about overheated property markets in places like China or even Hong Kong, which might sort of deter some investors. But then, you know, there's money still sort of piling into these areas. I mean, one area in particular I quite like at the moment is Indonesia in Southeast Asia. You know, it's got strong political stability. The economy is a resource-focused economy. It's doing very well indeed. And I think probably it's probably got one of the best performing property markets relative to where it was 12 months ago in the whole region at the moment.
And can you finally just give us your perspective on what is happening in China? I know that they are concerned about what's happening there. Do you think that that there is a bubble that is going to burst?
No, I don't think so. I think the Chinese economy is very well managed and the Chinese government is well able to sort of manage any escalations in asset values. You've got a rapidly growing economy that, you know, has been growing at almost double digits for quite some time. So with lots of liquidity, both in terms of, you know, equity and debt. And you're bound to see asset values appreciate. It's how you benchmark them. I don't think you can sort of just benchmark them against where they were 12 months ago or 5 years ago. You've got to sort of benchmark them against where affordability level, particularly the residential market. And I think also you've got to look at the debt levels.
Go and enjoy your dinner. And when I have 10 million or so to invest, I'll call you again. Thank you.
That was Chris Fossick there, the Vice President of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, on the phone from Hong Kong to our Monocle editor, Andrew Tuck. The time is 25 minutes past the hour.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. It's approaching the bottom of the hour, but let's have some music first. Glasser and Home. Glasser sounding all rather tinkly there on Monocle 24. The song was Home. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll be hearing from an intelligence expert on the Israeli-Iranian rumour mill, and we'll hear from our foreign editor and resident African football expert, Steve Bloomfield, on why the Eritreans are getting a reputation for buying one-way tickets. But first, Nick Kelly has the news headlines.
Thanks, Emma. The Arab League, stung into action by months of bloodshed in Syria, met opponents of President Bashar al-Assad today, a day after violence in his country claimed 69 more lives. The UN Security Council has strongly condemned attacks on foreign embassies in Syria by pro-government demonstrators and called on Damascus to protect diplomatic premises and staff. Three Norwegians accused of plotting with al-Qaeda's help to bomb a Danish newspaper for printing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad have pleaded not guilty to the charges in court today. France came under heavy fire on global markets today, reflecting fears that the Eurozone's second biggest economy is being sucked into a spiralling debt crisis after warning that Paris's failure to adapt should be ringing alarm bells. New York police evicted Occupy Wall Street protesters from a park in the city's financial district earlier today, 2 months after they set up camp and sparked a national movement against economic inequality. London city authorities said today they were resuming legal action to try to shift anti-capitalism protesters who've set up camp at St. Paul's Cathedral. Iraq's cabinet approved a $17 billion deal with Royal Dutch Shell and Mitsubishi today to capture gas that's now being flared off into the atmosphere at southern oil fields, according to a government spokesman. Venezuelan police say two more suspects have been arrested in the kidnapping of Washington Nationals baseball player Wilson Ramos. And Spain's Civil Protection for Volcanic Risk has closed two beaches on the island of El Hierro on the Canary Islands because of potentially toxic gases emanating from an underwater volcano eruption. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 31 minutes past the hour.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24,
ja.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afternoon to Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
24. 24. 24.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, and I'm joined by Monocle's correspondent, Sophie Grove. A very warm welcome to you, Sophie.
Hi there.
Now let's talk terrorism. When 17 members of the Iranian military died in an explosion at a munitions base near Tehran at the weekend, the initial reports was that it was just an accident. But then it emerged that one of the dead was the founder of Iran's missile programme, General Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam. This was then followed by unreported and unsubstantiated claims that this could have been sabotage. In fact, it could have been an attack carried out by the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad. Nigel West is a security and terrorism and counter-terrorism expert. Let me get that right for you, Nigel, who's written extensively on espionage. A very warm welcome to you, Nigel, here on Midori House. Let me start off by asking you, what at the moment do we clearly know about what happened?
We know there was a very large explosion about 25 miles from Tehran. We know that this was in a military base. We know that General Moghaddam was one of those who was killed. And he was the person at the head of the Revolutionary Guards Missile Brigade. And he's been in that role since 1983. And he's sort of the father of the intermediate-range ballistic missile program within Iran.
So what kind of effect is his death going to have on the Iranian regime?
Well, this is decapitating this particular organization. It will have an impact on its effectiveness, on future planning, and on the institutional memory of this particular organization. I mean, there's no doubt that there will be other people who will ultimately replace the general. But this does fit into a pattern of experts, nuclear physicists, other scientists who have met an untimely death over the past 5 years.
Now, the initial reports was that it was just an accident, that there were shifting munitions, an explosion occurred, and multiple casualties and deaths. And then, little by little, the Israeli connection has begun to emerge. But it hasn't been widely reported. Can you explain why you don't think it's been widely reported and what the current Israeli involvement is alleged to be?
Well, let me give you a parallel example of the nuclear facility in Syria that had been developed by the North Koreans with Chinese help and with support from AQ Khan from Pakistan, at a critical moment in the development of that particular site, there was a massive explosion, and the Syrians never claimed that there had been an attack, but the site was destroyed. The IAEA has made inspections and recovered nuclear material from the site for forensic examination. The Israelis never said a word, but it is generally accepted now that this was an attack, an air raid conducted by the Israelis. And the Israelis are usually very reluctant to acknowledge their participation in these events, partly because it inflames the Arab street. Also, it is of no advantage to them to do so. And from the Syrians' perspective, they have kept absolutely stum about the entire episode, because, of course, it's an affront to their national honor to have their airspace invaded in that way. So it's in everybody's interests, really, to almost pretend that it hasn't happened.
You say that it wasn't to the Israelis' advantage to bomb such sites.
Not to acknowledge the bombing.
Does it seem, I don't know how to describe this, but is it a little bit coincidental, and I don't know who is finding this coincident, that over the weekend the Israeli Prime Minister was calling for international help and has been sabre-rattling over the last few days about saying that either international intervention is needed to stop Iran's nuclear programme or wasn't actually ruling out the fact that military action would be taken? Does it seem would it seem too much of a coincidence for the Iranians to reply by saying, well, look, what you have just done, and point the finger quite quickly?
No, I think that the point really is the chronology of events. It may well be that first of all, the leaking and then the actual release of the IAEA report, which was critical of Iran's nuclear development program, could be interpreted as some kind of a catalyst for an attack on Iran. Quite interesting not to attack the nuclear sites that I guess most external observers would have expected, and instead to go for the delivery system. And so it sort of achieves almost the same end. So I'm not sure necessarily that this was prompted by the IAEA report, but it certainly gives good political cover for the Israelis.
Nigel, I wanted to ask you, I mean, this looks like, if this was the Israelis, it's a very audacious move. Is this typical Mossad? And how sort of infiltrated do you think that Mossad is into the Iranian territory?
Mossad has a reputation that is unjustified. It's a very small organisation. It is perfectly happy to accept the credit for many operations in the past that it had almost nothing whatever to do with. The rescue at Entebbe, for example, the removal of the gunboats from Cherbourg. None of this was anything to do with Mossad. That was Amman. Amman is the military intelligence organization in Israel. And when you look at the pictures of the participants from the video footage of the Dubai hit in January last year, To me, that doesn't look like a Mossad operation, although it's been described by that. Actually, those young men look very military. And my suspicion is that actually these were volunteers from Amman rather than from Mossad. But Mossad is quite happy to take the credit for that. The difficulty about these kind of operations is that intelligence agencies get a reputation based on things that go wrong. Because if something goes right, you're not really going to hear about it. And so if you try and spray poison gas into the face of the leader of Hamas in Amman, then that will go wrong. If you shoot the wrong person, an innocent Moroccan waiter in Lillehammer in Norway, and ballistic tests link the weapon to hits in Rome and Paris, that's just really bad tradecraft. And it sort of demonstrates that actually Mossad is not all that it's cracked up to be. Mossad be very happy to take the credit privately for these successes, but ultimately I'm not sure that they are actually directly responsible for them.
So do you think it's Mossad that sort of assassinated, you know, the five of these nuclear scientists in Tehran over the last couple of years? Who would that be if it wasn't Mossad?
Well, I would certainly say that it was most likely the Israelis. The extent to which they can run operations in Tehran is doubtful. You have to understand that part of the reason why Mossad is handicapped in the way that it is, it's a victim of history, in that most intelligence agencies depend on running operations from a local embassy. They have the benefit of the Vienna Convention. They have full diplomatic immunity. The worst that can happen is that they'll be declared persona non grata. Israel didn't have diplomatic representation in their target countries, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, you name it. These were countries that didn't have any relationship with Israel, so therefore they had to rely on illegals. And to send illegals into these countries is very, very difficult and very dangerous.
We're joined by Nigel West, who's a security and counter-terror expert here on Monocle 24, and we're talking about the explosion near Tehran, which killed several Iranian militants, military this weekend, including someone who's absolutely key to the founder, indeed, of Iran's missile program. Nigel, you're talking about the involvement of other countries, and it makes you think occasionally of Stuxnet, which was which I hope you can explain to our listeners a little bit more eloquently than I can. But that was thought to be Israeli in origin. But that was also had rumours connected to it about the involvement of the United States. How far does this web stretch?
Well, you have to look at the objective. The objective is to terminate Iran's nuclear program. Iran has had a civil nuclear program since 1954, and much of their program would appear to be legitimate. The reactors that have now been completed by the Russians are subject to IAEA inspection, and all of that is to be applauded. The difficulty is when you want to weaponize the fissile material, and that involves a process that can be interfered with, and the computer virus that you described was intended to sabotage the Siemens electric motors for the centrifuges used to separate the fissile material. And that appears to have been very effective, but physically obviously had to be carried in, perhaps in a flash drive, thumb drive, in order to contaminate the internal computer system, which naturally would not have been connected to the internet. But whether that set back the program 6 months or a year, who knows? The target, the objective, is to handicap that development program. And it looks like, despite the protests of the Iranian administration regime, that that program continues ahead. And therefore, it's in American and Israeli interests, and indeed stability in the Middle East, to prevent the testing of a nuclear weapon by Iran.
Nigel West, security and counterterrorism expert and writer written extensively on espionage, I understand. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House on Monocle 24. As too, thanks to Sophie Grove, our Monocle correspondent. Do you remember the late morning when we went back to bed? When we found the first position and every muscle rested? The last time you be mine. Anna Brune there, Do You Remember, here on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. The time is 13 minutes to the hour. We'll be back in a moment with our foreign editor and sports expert, Steve Bloomfield, with some footballers who just can't stop running.
There are few greater pleasures in life than a great meal. The Menu is just that, a weekly one-hour programme about eating and drinking. From growers to restaurateurs, we introduce you to the people you need to know, whether you're out dining in Osaka or out carousing in Sao Paulo. That's The Menu, brought to you in association with Krug, every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, A new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
And a very warm welcome back to Midori House's Studio One with Emma Nelson. And I'm joined by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. But you haven't just got your foreign editor hat on, you've got your football scarf on, haven't you?
I have. I've got a hat and a scarf on.
Brilliant.
It's winter now, you know.
You'll get a whistle in a minute. Because football is not a subject generally followed with a forensic eye by Monocle. But when the Eritrean football team takes the pitch today for a World Cup qualifying match in Rwanda, bear with me, Eritrea's autocratic government will be watching closely. But the final score might not be what's interesting them, because the tiny Red Sea nation has one of the worst national football teams in the world. Instead, they'll be wondering how many of the players will be coming home following the final whistle. This evening's match is the first time in 2 years that the Eritrean team has played away from home. This is because the last time, in Kenya, the entire team disappeared and it eventually claimed asylum and was then resettled in Australia. Now, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is also the author of a book about African football called Africa United. And you were in Nairobi to see the last match Eritrea played before they vanished, weren't you?
I was.
First question, before we go back to that, was what are the chances of them going back to Eritrea after the final whistle tonight?
I think actually pretty strong. I think they would not have played this match if they had any, if there was any indication they thought that this team was going to desert like the last one did. And also, Rwanda is a slightly autocratic nation and perhaps wouldn't look so kindly on a dozen or so Eritreans appealing for asylum. Whereas in Kenya, it was quite easy for them to slip away and then claim they did not want to go home.
Well, take us back to 2009.
Okay,
I
will.
What happened?
I'll paint you a picture.
Please do.
So Eritrea is, as you said in the introduction, one of the worst football teams in the world. They are about 190th in the world out of 200. And they're from a region, East Africa, which is similarly cursed with really bad footballers. That's unfair. Some of the footballers
are
good. Some of the footballers are good, but the teams, the national teams, are appallingly bad. And they have this tournament called the CECAFA Cup, which is the Central and East African Football Association Cup, which they hold every year. And it's essentially the worst football tournament in the world because all the teams in it are some of the worst national teams there
are.
You're
making it sound like something that actually is worth watching.
Oh, it really is. It really. Well, I think it's anyway. And so I was, when I was writing this book, I was also based in Nairobi, and I went along to a lot of these matches that they played this 1 year in Nairobi. And the Eritrean one I watched was Eritrea versus Somalia, which Eritrea won 3-1, which gives you an indication of how bad Somalia are.
I'm glad you can remember how much the score was.
I can also remember how many people there were there, because I was in a... There was me, and there was about 100 Somalis and a couple of Kenyan friends of mine, and that was about it.
Right.
There were just over 100 of us watching this international match. So not... it wasn't Wembley.
These are teams that have escaped the attention of the average Russian oligarch.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so then after the match, you know, it's all very informal. You can, you know, go onto the pitch and talk to the players. And so I spoke to a couple of Somalis and I thought, oh, I'll go and speak to a couple of the Eritreans. But they didn't speak English and I don't speak Amharic and didn't have anyone there to speak to. I thought, okay, well, never mind. I'll try and catch up with them later on in the tournament.
There wasn't going to be a later on, was
No,
it?
There wasn't. So they then played one more match, which they lost 4-0 and were then supposed to go home. And the plane was on the runway at Jomo Kenyatta Airport in Nairobi. And the coach turned up and the main official from the Eritrean Football Association turned up. And none of the players did.
Right. Where were they?
They'd all scarpered. They'd all... Kenya and Nairobi in particular has large migrant communities from lots of other East African countries. And so there are quite a lot of Eritreans in Nairobi. So it was actually quite easy for them to melt away. And basically what happened was, what we discovered subsequently was, they had a meeting, the team had a meeting and said they all, you know, knew that they didn't want to go back to Eritrea. It's a really nasty autocratic state where there are no freedoms whatsoever. It's been ruled by the same person ever since the country's existed when it got independence in 1993. So they all wanted to stay in Kenya and not go back to Eritrea. So they had this meeting and decided they were going to do it. and then found families and friends that were willing to take them in for a little bit. And then once the tournament was over, they then approached the UN refugee agency in Nairobi and said, we don't want to go back to Eritrea. Please look after us.
Now, this takes us back to a generation probably 20, 30 years ago when you had nothing but stories of Russians and former Eastern Bloc athletes getting to a safe haven and then suddenly finding a long-distance relative who could help them claim nationality, either British or what have you.
Exactly.
Is this a resurgence of flight, or is this a common practice in global sport?
It's one of those things that often happens with big sporting tournaments as well, actually. I think when the Commonwealth Games was held in Manchester in 2006, there were a few athletes from developing world countries that decided to stay. And there was also there was a really sweet story I came across in Sierra Leone, again while researching the book, 3 or 4 years ago. There was this young team called Johansson FC, who were all teenagers. They're sort of 15, 16-year-olds. And they were invited to this tournament in Sweden to play there. And traditionally, there'd been a problem with Sierra Leone players, teams going abroad in that, you know, just like Eritrea, people decide they didn't want to come home. It's for different reasons in Sierra Leone, more because the country's so poor that they felt they would have a better life somewhere else. So anyway, this team went off to Sweden, and then every single one of them came back. And the fact that every single one of them came back made front page news in Sierra Leone. It was seen as a real source of national pride that these guys went off to Sweden and were like, no, we're going home.
You're listening to Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, who's going to be talking more about disappearing footballers in just a moment.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And it's 5 minutes to the hour here at Monocle 24. A quick chat again with Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor and residential football expert. We're talking about fleeing Eritreans. What do you think the Eritreans can do, or the Eritrean authorities can do, to stop the footballers running away tonight?
Don't let them out of your sight, basically.
How do they do that?
Well, I'm fairly sure they'll have this match in Kigali, in Rwanda's capital. They'll then take them all back to hotel. They'll probably have security on the door of the hotel. And then the next morning, they'll get the plane back to Asmara, to Eritrea. They will not be wanting to let them out of their sight at all.
One question that I really have foolishly omitted to ask you, which is, you say that Eritrea is a very autocratic country. What are they worried about that's going to happen to them when they get back? I mean, is there any kind of military exercise or anything that they have to be subscribed to?
This is a country where everyone has to do national service, supposedly only for a year or two, but invariably, it goes on for many years after that as well. Around about one third of the population is in the military at some stage. It is a horrible life, and I went there for Monocle a couple of years ago and had an interview with the president, Isaias Afwerki, and he is he's a very charismatic president. So you can see why he came to power in the first place. But he has very set views on how the world works. And the interview that we did was carried on Eritrean State TV, which was a little bit peculiar sort of setup. And he starts accusing me of being a spy for MI6.
Right.
And normally when you're interviewing someone and they start going off on a weird tangent,
yes,
you might just think, well, I'll let this go because
yes,
we'll move on to the subjects I want to get him on. But I was aware it was also being broadcast on Eritrean State TV, so I had to argue back, and we ended up having a 2.5-hour interview, which was
live on Eritrean State TV.
Wasn't live. They decided to record it and then only play the bits where he seemed better than me, which was, I felt a bit unfair.
Surely, but I do argue a very, very short time to argue. So the Eritreans really have these kids got nothing to lose if they run away? What will
No.
happen that's bad if they go back? If they get caught, what might happen to them?
Well, if they get caught, I dread to think. But Eritrea is not a place you want to be as a young person. You know, you have no chance of getting ahead in the things you want to do. You have very little chance of freedoms. You'll remain in a life of pretty bad poverty, and with in a very sort of militarized autocratic state.
And in the last few seconds of this interview, could you possibly tell us how tonight's match may go and any predictions of scores, just in case?
Rwanda will win. Rwanda aren't that good either, to be honest. none of these teams in this region are very good at all, but Rwanda are slightly better than Eritrea. So I confidently predict a 2-0 victory for Rwanda.
Confidently predict 2-0 victory for Rwanda. We shall hold you to that. Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Our foreign editor there and also African football expert joining us on Midori House. Well, that's all from us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias, our researcher with Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Anna Veal. Nick Kelly's here with the headlines in just a moment. Then at the top of the hour, it's time for Section D with Hugo MacDonald. But you've been listening to Midori House from Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. This is Monocle 24.